Right, so taking me a bit longer to get through this than I'd planned, but I hope, you know, I certainly don't see that as a problem because I've been getting some great questions, and, you know, if I'm meandering a little, it's because there's a lot of side issues and side topics to think about. But let's at least recognise that for this last part, we are going to focus on space, because we've said enough about ground-based telescopes for now. So from here on in, it's really basically Hubble. So why would you want to observe from space? Well, first of all, the objects that we observe out there in the universe don't just give off visible light and radio waves and infrared. They give off radiation all across the spectrum. So here's quite a famous image of our Milky Way galaxy, and it shows not just starlight, but it shows light coming. I'll try putting the lights out just for a moment, just to let you see it rather better. Yeah. It shows light coming from dust clouds in the plane of our Milky Way galaxy. We live in a big spiral galaxy, but we're embedded within it, so we don't see the spiral structure for ourselves. We just see the band of light across the sky. But maybe if it's all right, I'll leave the lights off just for a few minutes. There's a couple of very striking images coming up that will look better with more contrast. Now here's a whole series of images of the centre of the galaxy, but at different wavelengths, and the kind of objects that would emit radiation at those wavelengths. Now I don't want to spend too long in this, but just to let you see that there's a lot of quite interesting stuff here. Things like pulsars, you know, little tiny neutron stars that are giving off pulses of very high energy radiation. There's cool stars, they're just not very hot, like the, not even as hot as the sun, but still, you know, a few thousand degrees. There's dust, which is just heated up by sunlight, so starlight. There's hot gas. There's exploding stars called supernovae. So the centre of our galaxy looks very different at all these different wavelengths. Okay, the way it's been represented is a bit of a cheat because we don't see in radio. So all we're doing here is taking the intensity of radio waves and turning it into a colour to give us some kind of sense. But nonetheless, you can see that the patterns look very different. So there's a lot to be learned by looking at more than just visible light. But how are you going to do that? Well, getting above the atmosphere is the way to do it. And over the last 20 or 30 years, there are many satellites that have been put into orbit which have looked at parts of the spectrum that we can't see with our own eyes. For example, one of the most famous of, I referred to them last week, the so-called Messier objects, a catalogue of clouds of gas. Well, the very first one in that catalogue is a remnant of a supernova that exploded in the year 1054. There's records of Chinese astronomers having seen it. And here's what it looks like from X-rays all the way through to radio. And here's an image taken with a very large telescope array in the visible. So the only way you're going to see most of these views is by getting above the atmosphere. Okay, you can see the visible, but not the rest. Now, final one of these sort of examples is another galaxy, not our own, but this is the Whirlpool Galaxy, the one that was drawn by the 3rd Earl of Ross from the telescope in Ireland. But now modern photographs of it, you can see many different wavelengths, visible, infrared, ultraviolet, radio, X-rays and so on. Now, the first person to begin to put forward this case for space was Lyman Spitzer. And I, for one, would have been not remotely unhappy if the space telescope had been named the Spitzer Space Telescope rather than the Hubble Space Telescope. To be fair, though, he still wound up with one named after him because the Spitzer Infrared Space Telescope was launched earlier this decade. And it was one of four great observatories that NASA envisaged. Spitzer made the case in a paper that he wrote in the 40s, I think it was. I've got that on a slide coming up. That the reasons why you want to get out into space to observe was the two that I've cited before. The light doesn't get absorbed and also it doesn't get scattered. And gradually a plan emerged that NASA wanted to build four of these. One was to observing gamma rays, the Compton Gamma Ray Observatories up in the top left. It was launched in 91, if I remember rightly. The Chandra X-ray Telescope, it was launched in 99. Hubble was launched in 1990 and Spitzer was launched, I think it was 2002, before it finally flew. But they've all made huge contributions by getting above the atmosphere and letting us see things that we couldn't see from the ground. Yeah, 46 was when Spitzer wrote his paper, Astronomical Advantages of an Extraterrestrial Observatory. And in fact, it was another 20 years before the US launched anything above the atmosphere that was designed specifically to take astronomical observations. The Orbiting Astronomical Observatory went up in 66. There's another one launched in 68 that was going to take ultraviolet observations. It did so for quite a few years. And it was around then that NASA began seriously to put plans on the table for a large orbiting space telescope. But budget cuts derailed that for a while. Then in the late 70s, things got off the ground again, no pun intended, rejuvenated plans, and the goal was to launch in 1983. Now, that meant that people had to start to be employed to do the building, to do the constructing, and had to be subcontracted. So an optics company called PerkinElmer, they began constructing the primary mirror, but there were all sorts of, the usual kind of problems, management, technical, and the launch was being postponed until 1985. In 83, there was an institute set up. It's in Baltimore in the US, associated with Johns Hopkins University, a quite famous university in the US, Space Telescope Science Institute. I've visited there a few times. It's still going strong. And as I was saying to somebody in the break, there's a very strong case, even if Hubble was to stop functioning right away, that you want to try and keep all that expertise that's been built up at Space Telescope Institute active and able to contribute to future space telescopes and future missions. Now, the construction was completed in 1985. There were five original science instruments, and here's just a few images of the construction in process, all done in clean rooms to try and stop dust and dirt contaminating the optics. And here in the sort of later stages where all the instrumentation is being assembled as well. So the five original instruments were these: something called a wide field and planetary camera, a high resolution spectrograph, a faint object camera, a faint object spectrograph, and a high speed photometer. Two cameras, two spectrographs, and a photometer. Well, a photometer is basically a camera as well. But whereas what a camera does is builds up a two-dimensional image, so you get a picture of what something looks like, all the photometer did, was intended to do, is collect the amount of light coming from a particular direction. In other words, you wouldn't get an image, a 2D image of a galaxy or something, but you would at least count how much light had come from there. And the reason why it was wanted to be high speed was, in fact, this wouldn't be relevant for galaxies, but some stars change. They explode, they pulsate, they do all kinds of changing things. And what the high-speed photometer could do could look at changes in the brightness of a star on very small timescales, much more rapidly than could be done from the ground, because we lose most of the light that comes to us at the ground. It's got scattered and absorbed by the atmosphere. So, here are just five. I've just stuck these in. You can have a look at these at your leisure. But these are just from the original design drawings of those five instruments. You know, somebody had to basically do the design, and then they had to be manufactured. So the drawings are there, but I won't dwell on the details. It's all a bit dull, really. But maybe the thing to emphasise is just a couple of general points about how astronomical instruments actually work. How would a camera work in space? How would a camera work on the ground increasingly these days, because we've all got digital cameras? It's based on the idea of what we call a charge-coupled device. So the squiggly red line is supposed to be some light, what we call a photon, a little packet of light energy, that comes along and it impinges on one of the little squares of our CCD, our charge-coupled device. So that's like a digital camera. Indeed, the technology for modern high-street digital cameras was originally developed in astronomy. And typically each one of those pixels is about 20 microns, 20 millionths of a metre across. And nowadays, even in the high street, 10 to the 7, that's 10 million pixels, is quite standard. I mean, some of you guys probably got digital cameras as good as that. I think mine is about 6 or 8 million. The state-of-the-art CCD mosaics that we have today have got roughly about 1 billion pixels. Hubble, not really very good. It's about 1,000 by 1,000 in the initial design. But remember, A, it was built more than 20 years ago, and secondly, it also had to be designed to be fairly robust to survive going up into space. I mean, if you imagine taking your prized digital camera, I did this with mine, and shaking it at 3 Gs for 20 minutes, it probably wouldn't look very good at the end. So it was a remarkable achievement to come up with technology that was useful, but also robust enough to withstand the rigours of being out in space. Now the details at the bottom are just a bit about how these things actually work. When the light comes along and impinges on the pixel, what it does is it kicks an electron, little fundamental particle, out of the semiconductor material. Now current in a circuit is just electrons moving around. So an electrical current will be generated by the electrons that are kicked out of the pixels. And all the CCD has got to do is keep track of which pixel produced which electron. And then you can work out how much light must have hit that pixel, and you can make an image. So that's how it works. There's also spectrographs on board Hubble. A spectrograph or a spectrometer kind of does the same thing, but instead of the light coming along and impinging directly on the CCD, what happens is that the light is first of all split up into its constituent colours. And that's done just using something like a piece of glass, a prism, although most modern ones, and certainly the ones on Hubble, use a related sort of instrument called a diffraction grating. But it does the same thing, it splits the light into its colours, and then you can get information not just from how much light you collect, but how much red light, how much blue light, how much yellow light, and so on. So the idea is that some white light comes along, gets dispersed or split into its constituent colours. See, a diffraction grating does the same thing, it actually bends the red light more than the blue, whereas in a prism it's the other way around. And then once that light has been split through the grating, or it could be a prism, it will be focused onto a detector, just like the CCD. So the detector part is going to be another digital camera, just like the wide field planetary camera and faint object cameras do the same job, but without splitting the light into its colours first of all. Okay? So back to our timeline. And here is where the story gets a bit more downbeat for a while, because first of all there were major delays in the launch of HST because of the Challenger disaster, and therefore Hubble, just like all other missions, was put on the back burner for a while. But on April 24th, 1990, it was finally launched on board the 31st Space Telescope mission, and the Space Shuttle Discovery, the Space Shuttle mission I should have said, and the Space Shuttle Discovery carried HST to low orbit. So HST actually only orbits, I think it's about 100 kilometres above the Earth, something around that. And therefore, it zips around the Earth pretty quick. It completes one orbit in about 90 minutes. And that also means it's continually going from the Earth's bright side to dark side over that timescale. So the very well publicised problems with Hubble were to do with the mirror, as we'll see in a moment. But there were other problems too, because it's powered by solar panels, and the solar panels got warped, and that meant that keeping it stable was not so easy, and that problem was exacerbated by the temperature gradient as it went in and out of the Earth's shadow. But here's how it should have worked. It looks at something, those signals are turned into electrical current in the CCDs, those signals are then beamed back down to Earth via a tracking and relay satellite to a ground station at White Sands in New Mexico, then they're transferred through NASA, Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, to finally get to Baltimore, and then arriving in the email inboxes of people like me who've got the chance to use Hubble telescope data. But on April 27th, when the shuttle was deployed, it was very quickly realised that there was a fundamental flaw in the mirror. So the mirror was designed beautifully, but just to the wrong design. Essentially, the secondary was in the wrong place for the design of the primary mirror, which meant the light wasn't being focused where it should have been. And that meant that the images were blurred. Now, here's a wee clip from the Sky at Night programme, because Jeff Hoffman, you know, was actually there on one of the repair missions, so he can say it a lot more convincingly perhaps than I can of just what a big deal this was. So here's what he has to say.
Hubble has been such an incredible success over all that time that I think many people forget what a disaster it was right at the launch when we discovered the optical problem, the despair, the outrage that the astronomical community, the public at large, the Congress in the United States felt. NASA was really in a crisis, and I was fortunate enough to have been on the mission which actually saved the public.
Isn't that exactly what the problem was?
Well, it turns out it was a spherical aberration of the main mirror, which is a very, very common error in amateur telescope.
That's about 1 micron.
That's about 1/50th the diameter of an average human hair. Very tiny, but it shows the precision with which Hubble operates, that just that tiny amount made it impossible to get good focus out of Barbara.
So, now, things got better in 1993 with the mission that Jeff Hoffman was on, which was the first of the repair missions. But just before we get to that, let me echo what he said about just it being a huge big deal. I mean, first of all, on a personal level, there I was trying to get my PhD finished and was relying on the fact that although I hadn't the need to use Hubble data, the results that I was working on were going to be made much more important in the next few years because they would be relevant to some of Hubble's main missions. And here, you know, the news was saying, well, Hubble isn't going to be able to do some of those things. And even in popular culture it was there. I don't know if any of you remember the movie Naked Gun 2.5, but there's a scene in that, it was released in 1991, where Frank Drebin, you know, Leslie Nielsen's character, goes into this bar called the Blue Note, I think, and it's the place where people go when they're really sad and depressed, and all round the pub there's things like the Hindenburg and the Titanic, and look, there's the Hubble telescope. So, you know, it was the epitome of disaster back then, even in the popular consciousness. No, well, I'm not sure what this one is, actually. I don't know, that must have been some design of car that was...
It's a very strange radiator. It made it look like a woman's female parts.
Right.
The real flop, because it just people put up on the way it
looked. I see. Yeah. So anyway, as they said in the article on the Sky at Night programme, in the little feature, it was just 4 microns too flat at the edges. That's 4 millionths of a metre, or 4/1000ths of a millimetre. And that was all. And this was essentially the problem. So as a result, instead of the light being focused all where it should have been, then the light was splashed over a region several arc seconds across. Now, COSTAR was what Jeff Hoffman was involved in. That was the cavalry that had come to try and fix this, because it's a corrective optics space telescope. NASA and its acronyms, it's always hard to remember. Corrective optics system. My apologies for not remembering. And what COSTAR did was effectively give Hubble a pair of glasses, because it meant that the light was modified before it hit the detectors to make it mimic as if it had come from a telescope of a different design. So that was the goal. And that was a mission that was launched in 1993. So we'll say a bit more about the service missions in a moment. Now, they practiced for this a great deal, because, you know, it would have been an even greater disaster if the repair mission hadn't worked. So they did all the usual stuff, you know, practicing in underwater tanks. Remember that this whole assembly, the wide field planetary camera and the COSTAR corrective optics system, they weighed several hundred kilos, but because you're weightless in space, they could just kind of manoeuvre it around very easily, which is both a good thing, but also, you know, it means that they could quite easily bash it into something and maybe damage the equipment. But here's some footage from the shuttle as they were approaching the space telescope. Now, I especially like this one because you can see that the solar panels are very badly warped and that was one of the other things they had to repair. Now, we can maybe blame the Americans for messing up in the mirror design, but actually British Aerospace had a hand in the design of the solar panels, so we've got to carry the can for some of that as well. So they got the telescope back into the payload bay, and then they did their stuff. There's some really beautiful photographs of this. You know, this is the kind of stuff that they show in IMAX film, so very, very high resolution images of the spacewalks and so on. Not quite such a high resolution image, but that's the COSTAR corrective optics system being taken out of the payload bay, ready for insertion into the space telescope.
So it's hard to be taken in and out.
Yeah, I think I've got, actually maybe I didn't put that clip in, but Jeff Hoffman, maybe just a few seconds after the clip I showed ended, made the comment that NASA had always intended that the shuttle would function in that manner, that basically, you know, you would run an instrument for a few years and then you could take another one up and put it in. I mean, I couldn't find this, sadly, but I had a book when I was a kid, you know, as it may not come as a huge surprise to you to learn that I was quite keen in astronomy when I was very young, and an elder brother or sister must have got me this book. It's by Patrick Moore from the mid-70s. And I'm pretty sure in that book they said that the plans at that point were for an astronaut to spend his time up on the space telescope, you know, changing the photographic plates the way that people used to back in the early years of the 20th century. You know, it's one thing Edwin Hubble spending his time stuck up, you know, Mount Palomar for night after night, but being stuck in low Earth orbit seems above and beyond the call of duty. So by the time I got serious about astronomy and was studying it at university in the mid-1980s, it was already very clear by that point that it was going to be remotely operated and with digital technology. But there was maybe a time in the early days when that just was unimaginable. Oh yes, I think this is the video clip that I was referring to, so let's just watch this.
When you got to Hubble, what was our actual route?
Our actual mission followed several years of painstaking analysis by astronomers and optical engineers, where they figured out what the problem was, and then they developed some very clever ways of installing corrective optics. And that was our job, was to install those corrective optics.
That meant spacewalking, of course.
Well, one of the remarkable things about Hubble was that it was designed from the very beginning to be serviceable by spacewalking astronauts. That meant that you can actually operate Hubble much in the same way that we operate ground-based telescopes, where you build a telescope, they have a mirror, the mirror is then fixed. But as years go by and detector technology improves, you continually upgrade the detectors that you put at the focal point. This had never been possible with telescopes in space before. Hubble was unique because of that ability. We knew that capability to remove and install instruments with high precision to actually be able to install the corrective optics.
Okay, look, so let's look in a bit more detail about what was done and how things improved after the COSTAR corrective optics system was put in. So this is a similar diagram to what we saw before. That's the way in which the light from a point source, like a star, which ought to be just a little point of light, one single pixel in your CCD, but instead the light was spread out over a much larger area. But then what COSTAR did was to adjust the light path through the telescope optics so that it would be back to what it should have been. But of course, the difficulty here was that the telescope was up there in space. So what had to be done was an analysis had to be made of what the problem was, just using the information that we had from the stars that could be seen. Nobody could actually go up there and just measure the telescope mirror. It was already out in space and it was too late to do that. So the statement I made a few minutes ago that it was 4 microns too thick at the edge, well, that was a kind of statement that had been deduced from what could be seen with Hubble. No one could be absolutely sure that that was what was really wrong. And consequently, it really was a big concern. You know, even assuming that the astronauts could put COSTAR in properly when it was switched on, so to speak, would it really correct the images the way that it was hoped? Well, fortunately, the answer was yes. And I remember seeing some footage of this because I was already a postdoctoral researcher by then. And you know, NASA's got its own TV channel. You know, I think I was over in the States around the time, and they were rerunning footage of, you know, how everyone was cheering wildly as the first images came through. And, you know, you can't blame them because it was people's careers were on the line. To some extent, mine was, because, as I said, you know, one of the things I was hoping to use Hubble data for was to measure the distances of galaxies like these. And we'll talk about that in a few weeks' time. It was using a type of star called a Cepheid variable star. And you just couldn't find the Cepheids in the left-hand image because the galaxies were too blurred. But with CoSTAR, it became possible to observe Cepheids in very distant galaxies, and then we could use them to work out how far away the galaxies were. And in turn, that became the key step in measuring what we call the Hubble constant, the number that measures how fast the universe is expanding. And if there's one single reason why this was called the Hubble telescope, rather than, as I said, the Spitzer telescope, it's because HST was envisaged as a way that you could measure the Hubble constant. So if CoSTAR hadn't worked, then really it would have been a very badly named telescope, and I might not have got myself a faculty position in 1998. But fortunately it did work. So after CoSTAR, things hugely improved. But the other thing that the first servicing mission did was to install a new wide-field and planetary camera. The original wide-field and planetary camera was, as I said, you know, a pixel array of about 1,000 by 1,000. In fact, it was a mosaic of CCDs, each one with about that size. But the CCD capabilities have got progressively better as each servicing mission has taken place. So let's take a bit of a look at those. First of all, just a few words about CoSTAR. Well, I've really kind of covered all this already. But what I didn't say was that there was a price to be paid. What CoSTAR did was it replaced the high-speed photometer, because there wasn't any space to put the corrective optic system unless something was taken out first. Now, I wasn't involved in those decisions. I was too young, I suppose. But that must have been a heck of a committee meeting, that one, where they had the chief investigators for the five main instruments, and somebody had to kind of agree to fall on their sword and be the one that would be removed to allow CoSTAR to be inserted. So that meant that immediately Hubble was not going to be able to do some things that it had been designed to do, but it was perceived that that was the one that was least damaging for the overall goals of the mission. That would prevent you being able to look at objects that are varying very fast, but it could still allow you to look at very far away things, very faint things, because you would still have the wide field and planetary camera and the faint object camera. Now, the other thing to mention at this point is that because the problem had been identified and fortunately solved with CoSTAR, all subsequent instrumentation that was built for the Hubble could be designed already taking the problem into account. So eventually you wouldn't even need CoSTAR. And we're just about to reach the point where all the instruments on board Hubble are already, if you like, pre-corrected for the problem. A bit more on that in a minute. But again, here's, you know, this is the centre of a distant galaxy, and you can see much less blurred after CoSTAR. So the other instrument that was put in 1993 was the Wide Field Planetary Camera. Actually, that should say 1997 and 1993, because the first two servicing missions involved replacing the original instruments, that was introducing second generation instrumentation. So the Wide Field and Planetary Camera was replaced by WFPIC 2. We'll say a bit more about that in a minute. The High Res Spectrograph was replaced by the Space Telescope Imaging Spectrograph, and indeed the Faint Object Spectrograph, kind of essentially the two original ones, were combined into this single bit of kit. And the High Speed Photometer was replaced by CoSTAR. Then in 2002, the faint object camera, which was especially good at seeing very small, distant, faint objects, was replaced by something called the Advanced Camera System, which was responsible for many of the really amazing images that we've had in the last 4 to 5 years. So let me say just something about each of those in turn. First of all, WFPIC 2. So this was the real sort of workhorse instrument for a long time. It was installed in 93 when the first servicing mission took place. So CoSTAR was the really important thing, otherwise nothing would work. But WFPIC 2 was also put in as well. Now, what is the basic design. Well, as I said, it's a kind of mosaic of CCDs. So what you've got is three little ones here. That's the planetary camera part. The CCDs can take much more fine detail. They're designed, you know, to have a higher resolution, sort of, better pixel resolution. Whereas the wide field camera has got sort of wider field of view, is the big square. But because you've got the planetary camera in there as well, it means you never get a full square image. You always get the little sort of L shape cut out the edge. So there's some facts and figures there. So we needn't get too bogged down in those, but they're all there if people are interested. So just to reiterate that, you've got the wide field camera, you've got three of them. Each of these would be a CCD with, as I said, you know, originally about 1,000 by 1,000. Then the planetary camera would be essentially just this bit in here. So that would leave your square. Now the image in the planetary camera, you might recognise that's a little bit of the Hubble Deep Field. So the whole thing's the Hubble Deep Field, but the planetary camera could sort of stare at just a portion of it even more deeply and see, you know, the most remote things. So this is from 1996, just within a few years of the servicing mission, and already it had produced one of the most iconic images throughout the whole of Hubble's mission. But then in 1997, the focus shifted a little bit, because, as we said earlier, putting a telescope up in space opens up a much wider window of the electromagnetic spectrum. So instead of just looking in the visible, it was always the plan that Hubble should look in other areas of the spectrum as well, that it could see. And remember, the technology here, it's not so much that there's the limit to what the telescope can see. The photons arrive from space, but the detectors have to be able to respond to them. And there's a narrow range of frequencies to which the detectors were sensitive. But nonetheless, a new instrument was put up with detectors that were sensitive to near-infrared photons. So NICMOS was a combination of a camera and a spectrometer. So it could take images, and it could also split the light up into different wavelengths to see what those different wavelengths and colours would tell you. And NICMOS, because it was sensitive to the near-infrared, was very good at seeing dust. Dust emits in the infrared. Like if you have a bright star but it's shrouded in dust, what will happen is the dust will heat up. And the wavelength of the light that's principally given off by the dust will be longer than the typical wavelength of the light from the star itself. So consequently, what you get is you get a lot of infrared light from things like dust clouds where stars are forming, or dust in a newly forming galaxy that's got lots of hot stars in it. The hot stars irradiate the dust and then cause the dust to glow. So those were the kind of things that NICMOS tried to look for. And we'll devote some time in the weeks to come to looking in more detail at the types of things we've learned by NICMOS's infrared view of the universe. So the Space Telescope Imaging Spectrograph, it was launched and inserted in 97 as well on the second servicing mission. And well, the thing to stress here was just that it had a very sort of impressively better field of view than the original spectrograph. Now this diagram looks a bit weird, but what you're seeing here is information about the different colours of the light, but also information of where that light is coming from. So you've got both spatial information and wavelength information. And I'll save explaining the details for a subsequent week. We're just doing a quick tour first of the instrument. But the sorts of things that STIS was used to look at was things like gas flowing out of a big thing like the centre of a galaxy, an image where it's not just a point of light, it's an extended source, and you want to work out whether the stuff on this side of the source is moving with a different speed from the stuff on the other side of the source. Now the speed at which the gas is moving can be revealed by a spectrometer, because the faster something moves, the more the wavelength of the light emitted by it is shifted. It's just like what happens with sound when you hear a police car siren go past. So you want to have both the imaging information and you want to have the wavelength information, because that tells you about position and speed. So STIS has been very good for that. Then the third servicing mission was in 2002, and that's when the advanced camera for surveys was placed. So this was designed to extend the wavelength in the other direction, a bit more out into the ultraviolet, and also in infrared, so you know, a very wide range of wavelengths, and to give as wide as possible a field of view. And as you can see, its field of view was nearly twice that of the wide field planetary camera that had preceded it. So it's been used for all sorts of things, studying galaxies again, and much of the work that's been carried out in a field that we call gravitational lensing, where you're trying to look for patterns in the shape of galaxies over large areas of the sky, has been done using the advanced camera for surveys. And again, a topic that we'll return to later. So that's kind of basically where things are right now. This is a sort of cutaway diagram. Again, it's way too small to read from where you're sitting perhaps, but you can always download it and look later. There's WIFPIC 2, which has subsequently been replaced by the advanced camera system. You've still got Nick Moss up there now, which replaced what did Nick Moss replace again? It's multi-object spectrometer, so it and STIS together replaced the faint object spectrometer and the wide field spectrometer. And then you've basically, in addition to that, just got COSTAR up in this corner, and then you've got guidance sensors and all kinds of stuff, just to make sure that the thing actually works and points where it's supposed to point. But what lies ahead? Well, it should have happened already. One of the reasons why I proposed this course for this year is that in October of 2008, there was supposed to be a fourth servicing mission, so I thought there might already be some new data, and that we could include in this course some of the results of that. Because the wide-field planetary camera has been replaced by a new wide-field camera with WFC3. COSTAR isn't needed anymore, because WFC3 has been designed to take the problems into account already, as had ACS and as had STIS. So there's now nothing left on board, or there will be in a few months' time, which requires COSTAR. So that's gained you an extra instrument. And COS is essentially an instrument that's designed for doing cosmology for, well, let me just talk about wide field camera first of all. The wide field camera is going to be able to, you know, again, just do slightly better because it's got higher resolution cameras. I mean, look at that, 16 megapixels. Now, sure, you can get better digital cameras on the ground than that, but not that much. You'd probably have to pay a lot of money for them. Obviously, these were expensive too. But the more important point is that they are able to withstand the rigors of being out there in space. So the technology's improved hugely in the 15 or so years. They're also made by a UK-based company, so I can be a wee bit parochial about that. High-performance chips designed for operating in space, but also to be sensitive from the near-infrared all the way through to the ultraviolet, so you can look at this wide range of frequencies. So there's some facts and figures there. I won't go through them, but as you can see, the array size is now 4,000 by 4,000 instead of 1,000 by 1,000. So, you know, that's pretty good for space. Now, I know you take a digital camera image with many of our cameras and you might typically get 4,000 by 4,000. But here we're talking about 4,000 pixels in an area that's, you know, tiny. So the detail you're getting is still very, very impressive. And some of the things that it will look to try to do, we'll talk about in weeks to come. We'll look at what HST's already done and talk about some of the things that it might do when the new instrumentation is in place.
Yep. Tripod and
you do indeed.
Yes.
Yep. It's exactly the same here.
Down there, 90 minutes.
Well, there's long exposure and long exposure. First of all, I mentioned just in passing, FGS, that stands for fine guidance sensors. So those are designed to keep the telescope trained on the same object.
Right.
So actually, it's got to move, it's got to track, because it's orbiting, then, you know, if the exposure time is even just a few seconds, then if it was just pointing at the same, well, I mean, what I mean is it's got to point at the same direction in space, but as it's orbiting, that means it's, you know, let me demonstrate. As I look at you and walk along, I've got to turn myself as I move. It's obviously exaggerated. Exactly. And that, for example, is why the problem with the solar panels was a real problem, because the warping of the solar panels meant it was extremely difficult to keep the telescope stable and pointing the right way. It would wobble, and that all had to be dealt with as well. But yeah, this is a great challenge. And in fact, the James Webb Space Telescope, as we'll see in subsequent weeks, is a fundamentally different design. It's going to be put out about 1 million kilometres from the Earth, in a place where the temperature doesn't vary very much. It's even got a sunshade so that it doesn't heat up too much, because it's looking for infrared, and moreover, that means it should also be very stable and can do long exposures. Now, the Hubble Deep Field was a very long exposure, but the way that it was done was that it looked at the same part of sky for a while, you know, a few seconds, then on the next orbit it would look again, and it would build it up that way. And you kind of hope that nothing had changed in the 90 minutes since you last looked at it. Yeah. Guide stars. One of the best stellar catalogues we have right now is called the Hubble Telescope Guide Star Catalogue. And the thing is, of course, that info can be used for all sorts of other things. But for Hubble, it was essentially just designed to be kind of, you know, to make sure it was looking at the thing it really wanted to see, which was some object much further away. But the positions of those stars are just carried in the memory very, very accurately, so that, you know, they can be sure that they're pointing in the right place. Yeah. Okay, so just last thing to say then we'll close up for tonight. The Cosmic Origin Spectrograph is the final instrument really probably ever to go on Hubble, because I think the intention of the last servicing mission is to see it through and to overlap a bit with the James Webb Space Telescope, but I really don't think there'll be a fifth servicing mission, other than the likelihood that they'll have to have a mission to make sure that it crashes safely, you know, because it'll burn up in the atmosphere. Some of you might remember when Skylab came down, there was worry about it might land in someone's head, so you wouldn't want that to happen with Hubble either. But there's no plans that I'm aware of to extend the science lifetime of Hubble beyond the next 5 to 10 years. Well, that would already be very impressive.
Why bring it down here at all? Why not just kind of space?
Well, in a way, we don't really have any choice. Because it's not in a very high orbit, it means that it gets a lot of friction from the atmosphere. There's hardly any atmosphere up there, but there are still some. So the orbit does decay, and if we're not careful, it's going to burn up. But it's so big that it wouldn't totally burn up. So what you want to do is make sure that it doesn't, you know, it's like the equivalent in space of a controlled explosion. You want to make sure that it comes down when you want it to, rather than in the middle of London or something. So that's what lies ahead for Hubble. And what lies ahead for us, I suppose, is, well, 8 more weeks of talking about all the science. So I hope you've enjoyed sort of hearing a bit more about how it was developed, what's on board, some of the stuff I've just skated over in the final 20 minutes tonight, you know, the instrumentation. We'll learn more about that as we see what was actually done with things like STIS and COSTAR, not COSTAR, NICMOS, and the Advanced Camera System. But this at least gives you a flavour, and lets you see, as the video clip said, that it was a fundamentally different approach from what was maybe originally planned, that as soon as they had the shuttle, and as soon as they had the means to send people up on spacewalks, then it was realised that what they could do is have an instrument on board for a wee while, a few years, and then replace it with something even better. And I think that has hugely helped to extend Hubble's usefulness than if it had just been the first generation instruments way back in 1990. Okay? So thanks very much, and I'll see you, I really will see you this time in 2 weeks. Alex is going to talk next week about Hubble and the solar system.